Welcome, everyone, to this talk by Professor Niall Green, Persianate Japanology, the Reach and Limits of Inter-Asian Exchange. I'm Andrew Newman. I'm chair of the Outreach Committee for the British Institute of Persian Studies. It is my great pleasure to introduce Professor Niall Green from UCLA, where I did my own PhD many years ago. Professor Green holds the Ibn Khaldun Endowed Chair in World History at UCLA. He's a former Guggenheim Fellow, and his many previous books include Bombay Islam, The Religious Economy of the West Indian Ocean, which won the Middle Eastern Studies Association's Albert Hirani Book Award and the Association for Asian Studies Ananda K. Kumaraswamy Book Award. The Love of Strangers, What Six Muslim Students Learned in Jane Austen's London, which was a New York Times Editor's Choice. And most recently, Global Islam, A Very Short Introduction. His newest book, How Asia Found Herself, A Story of Intercultural Understanding, will be published by Yale in the fall of this year. And he hosts the podcast Akbar's Chamber, Experts Talk Islam. So without further ado, I'm going to turn my image and my sound off and turn it over to Professor Green. Professor Green, thank you so very much. We're looking forward to this.
Thank you so much. I hope you can hear me, Andrew and others. I'll take that as a yes. Well, thank you all for tuning in on this Wednesday afternoon, evening, or indeed morning, if you're in the West Coast of the US, as I am. It's my great pleasure to be talking to you all through BIPS. BIPS funded my first trip to Iran back in 1996, so I still feel I sort of owe a debt of gratitude to the organization. And yeah, again, my thanks to Professor Newman, to Imogen Edwards, and to Sylvia Ferrari for helping invite and organize this. So, a person in Japanology with a question mark. I'm one of the things I've been trying to assess with my studies of Iranian, Afghan, and indeed more broadly Persian at Urdu, et cetera, and indeed Ottoman, and accounts of Japan over the last years has been to ask whether we have something that we might call Japanology in terms of what might I mean by that, but at the very least, a kind of, let's say, linguistically robust attempt to interpret another culture. So I'll be playing between the distinction between Japanophilia, fascination, and indeed a love of Japan, and whether this necessarily turned into what we might call then a Japanology. I'm looking then at the reach, the expanse across Eurasia, but also the limits, the intellectual, the linguistic, the conceptual constraints of inter-Asian exchange, inter-Asian understanding. That's the theme of my forthcoming book, which Professor Newman kindly mentioned, How Asia Found Herself, A Story of Intercultural Understanding. You'll notice on the cover here, I've chosen a Japanese image, although the book deals with Southeast Asia and China, as well as Japan. Japan was my intellectual starting point for this book, and indeed for this talk. And so we'll note there on the cover an image of the famous Yokohama-e, the Yokohama School of Painting that developed in the port city of Yokohama, which became Japan's window to the world, including the Middle East. And we'll see here on the right here from the same image, not only the European traders turning up in Japan there, but also Middle Eastern figures, traders, and indeed sailors there in Yokohama as well. But my own interest in particular, going beyond what we've seen in the last 10, 20 years of a sort of a global history, a Middle Eastern history of kind of interconnections, but I'm trying to understand whether connection necessarily led to comprehension, whether inter-Asian, intercultural connections, particularly trade and infrastructural connections, necessarily led into intercultural understanding, in this case then today, Japanophilia. So the broader questions then that I'm sort of within my book that fit into the talk today are how East and Southeast Asia was interpreted, culturally, linguistically interpreted in West and South Asia and vice versa. In other words, how Japan for today's purposes, but also China and Burma, Buddhist Southeast Asia, were understood in India and the Middle East, including Iran, in the period between around 1840 and 1940, the high period of empire, the high period of imperial globalization, in the period of what I've called elsewhere the age of steam and print. So my book takes is based on a number of key premises which undergird my presentation today as well. First of all, an empirical approach. I'm not interested, I'm not basing my work methodologically on assumptions that that Asia could understand itself, the different Asian cultures were necessarily inherently interrelated or mutually intelligible. I'm even, as we'll see in a moment, questioning the very broad concept of Asia as a framing interpretive category. Instead, I've been basing my research and my findings on an empirical approach, by which I mean trying to find evidence, primarily then written evidence, necessarily, that can allow us to assess the levels of cultural, linguistic, conceptual, theological understanding, which necessarily takes place in words and therefore in written documents and written evidence, my empirical approach. Secondly, then, I'm taking the communicational approach, not least in this era then of 1840, 1940, the period on which my book and my talk today focuses, then the age of steam and print, then a period in which we can actually frame this understanding as part of an expanding infrastructure of communication, steam and print, which also had its limits and its kind of structuring path dependencies, so to speak. A communication approach then that also allows us to understand, or at least to sort of guesstimate, what was understood by societies in the broader sense, because the books I'm looking at were printed books and indeed journals and newspaper articles that entered then the printed public sphere that emerged in this time. So a communication approach based on trying to assess what different Asian societies understood one another, what the Persian world understood of Japan then, in today's case, then being the understanding, being understanding in the public realm of print. I'm also, though, in building upon these two premises then, interested then in trying to identify the barriers of language and script. It's all very well to go to Japan, as I did myself 10 years ago when this project began, and then realized that I might have been to many other regions of Asia, but this country was, particularly in terms of language and script, utterly baffling. That led me to question then, on that first trip to Japan, how did other Asian travelers understand the country, which we've known for a good many years, that there were a good many visits of from Middle Eastern and other Asian scholars in the 19th century. Did such connection then necessarily lead to comprehension? Particularly then when we try to go beyond, let's say, you know, kind of a few kind of, you know, phrases that I learned on that first trip then, a few kind of, you know, hellos, goodbyes, thank you very much, but to actually have a deeper cultural, conceptual understanding of another Asian society, culture and set of traditions. That led me, my other key premises then are more historiographical, rejecting then the Silk Road model of continuity of cultural interactions and understanding across Asia, which of course has been, you know, kind of especially influential in the last 20 years, not least, but of course not only, but not least because of course the promotion of the Silk Road model through Chinese soft power diplomacy. I'm also cautious about the back projection, the very easy back projection of late or partial knowledge. Just because Iranians or Indians in the later 20th century or the 21st century know all kinds of things about Japan, we shouldn't assume that that knowledge was known, let's say, in 1940 or 1900 or 1840, let alone earlier. And my other key premise then is rejecting and certainly questioning Asia as a universal, emic, a neutral category of analysis, because so much of the scholarship in recent years of inter-Asia understandings, or indeed inter-Asia networks, has been premised on the notion that Asia is indeed a universal, neutral, and emic internal category. My book and project then begins with following how this concept, this model, this geographical idea of Asia travels east through Katib Celebi's Jahan Numa, which was then printed in the 18th century. And of course, we can see here Kharitay Asia coming then into Arabic script, into the Middle East and into the public sphere of print with Mutafarika's prints of the in the 18th century. And indeed, in the 1850s, a very famous and influential Persian work, the Kitab-i Jami Jam, translated by Farhad Mirza in the 1850s. And what this actually is, I've traced, is the translation of a geographical textbook by an English schoolmaster who was far from a geographical expert, let alone on Asia. But nonetheless, it took the idea of Asia and the term Asia to Iran as well. What about Japan? Well, what's in a name? Well, of course, nowadays in Iran at least, Japan is known as Japun. But we can actually trace then through these maps and through these translated geographical works, the movement then of a geographical moniker for Japan from the Latin Japonia of the European mapmaker Mercator's maps, his world atlas that was translated then and adopted into Katib Çelebi's aforementioned Cihannama and printed by Muteferika. And here we have the Cezire Japonia, the island then of Japonia, from the Latin, Mercator's Latin of Japonia to the Ottoman Japonia, then going into earlier 19th century Persian and Urdu as Japan, and then to modern Japun. The point being then that from the very beginning of this period of understandings of Japan in the Persian world in the 19th century, we have an external European, ultimately Latin term for Japan, and not an emic Japanese term based upon either the Japanese names of Nippon or later Nihon. Well, these informational networks spread in many ways out of India, particularly Calcutta, and as a great informational bourse for understanding of Asia, that then spread through India's much more highly developed public and commercial printing sphere to other regions of Asia, especially Iran. There were such books, then translations of Lawrence Oliphant's History of China and Japan, based upon a diplomatic journey to Japan, printed in Lucknow, as we can see relatively quickly then. The speed of informational movement is one of my interests as well. Printed pretty quickly, 8 years after the original edition in Edinburgh. India was also at the center of a series of not only translations from English, but translations of Middle Eastern languages as well. So we have translations into Urdu from Arabic as well, such as the Ali Ahmad Jirjawi's well-known Arabic travelogue to Japan, which is translated in Urdu, again, kind of very quickly, almost pretty much simultaneously from its translation, its original publication in Cairo. Well, turning to Iran, what's notable here is with the 1880 mission of Yoshida Masaharu, the beginnings of Irano-Japanese diplomatic relations, but also the end. This wasn't continued until another 60 years or so. And what we notice here then are two things. One, that there was no common language of diplomatic exchange here. It was actually English that had to serve at this point as the intermediary language of communication. English, and I think for other members of the diplomatic party, German. And secondly, although this trip resulted in a series of Japanese accounts, the earliest direct Japanese accounts, travelogues, etc., in Iran by members of the party, the diplomatic party, it didn't immediately at that point develop into corresponding, at least in print, that I'd be able to find, Iranian accounts of Japan, certainly not direct ones. Nonetheless, Calcutta and particularly Calcutta and Bombay and Iranian exile printing starts to spread knowledge from Japan via India and its trade networks, and then through the trade and public sphere of Indian Ocean ports to Iran by such Iranian exile Persian newspapers as Habl-e Matin and Azad, which indeed had their covers as well as reporting on Japan, taken largely from European and English newspapers available in Calcutta and Bombay, but were nonetheless also had subscriptions in China and Japan, suggesting that there is then this oceanic public sphere that's emerging at this time, not least to Yokohama, the port I began with. Bombay too, a very notable book, one of my most fascinating sources I found, a book published in 1893 by the famous Iranian exile publisher, Malik al-Kutab, the king of books, Shirazi, the Mirat al-Zamandat Tarikh Chin wa Machin in Japan, the mirror of the age or the mirror of the times, published in 1893, at a time when Iranian merchants then, particularly those based in Bombay and Calcutta, were building on the backs of British imperial trade to enter the Japanese market. Presumably the book then was marketed towards them. Yet despite the fact that the title suggests that this is a mirror of the times, a contemporaneous account, as I read through the book I gradually became sort of suspicious, and I just had an inkling that this might have been a much more famous earlier account of Japan, of China rather, as well as despite the fact that it has Japan at the end. And I gradually realized by comparison with the Latin original and the English translation, that this was in fact Matteo Ricci's early 1600s account of China that had been translated then into Persian and then pitched by this publisher as a mirror of the times. Of course, it was several centuries, almost three centuries out of date by this point, not very useful then to would-be Iranian merchants in Japan. It also had appended to the end, though, a short account of Japan, a mere three pages, in fact, that gave an account of basic geography. Japan is made up of several islands. It's built up and populous. And interestingly, the locals call it Nippon or Nifun. So that emic name for Japan enters Persian, but doesn't catch on, doesn't supersede the Latin-derived European name, which, if I remember correctly, originally comes from a Malay name that gets taken by the Dutch to Mercator and then into Latin and then back to the Ottomans and then eastwards into Persian and to Urdu. We also see, fascinatingly, at the end, this is a lithographic book, of course, then also many of the books I look at in this age of steam and print are visual representations too. And we have here, not Richard McCartney, not Lord McCartney, and still less Paul McCartney, but as you can read here, all of you, I'm sure, the Pachoi Hali Chin and the Pachoi Hali Japan. These representations then, which were, of course, were very much out of date by the time that the book was being produced, because certainly the Meiji Emperor of Japan was not dressing in this way. What we're seeing then here, as I've suggested there, is that there is an interrelationship between trade networks, between connection, between the steamships then, the P&O steamships, as well as the Nippon Yusen Kaisha, the Japanese steamship services that connected Yokohama and Kobe with Bombay and Calcutta from the mid-1880s. But again, those connections didn't necessarily feed into a corresponding level of intercultural comprehension, not least at the linguistic and direct level. Remember, what we're looking at so far is still mediated and often very outdated accounts of Japan written by a series of European outsiders with their own very variable degrees of cultural competency and linguistic competency. Also, I thought I'd show you a couple of these wonderful images, a series of matchboxes collected by Michael O'Sullivan, my former graduate student now at Harvard and moving to the European University Institute. I hope you'll be inviting him to BIPS lectures in future. These give us a sense then of the cultural dimensions then of these trade networks. But nonetheless, as I'm pointing to, when we actually look at sort of linguistic textual evidence constraints. So in 1897, then we have a Persian merchant turns up in Yokohama, the well-known Ibrahim Sahaf Bashi. He spends 6 weeks there. And it's an interesting account because it happens before the Russo-Japanese War and the burst of Japanophilia that follows then across the Middle East, including Iran. He gives a sense then, Sahaf Bashi, of the real cultural and culinary alterity of Japan. He gives what to my knowledge is the first Persian account of sushi, or at least sashimi. Raw fish that they eat with two sticks. But nonetheless, this isn't necessarily an approving account. It reminds me rather of Levi Strauss's famous account of le cru et le cuit, the raw and the cooked, as the markers of civilization and barbarity. Nonetheless, even though this is an account of a Japan of but parasti, of idol worship, there's a certain infernal appeal that Sahaf Bashi feels as he visits a giant iron but, a giant iron Buddha image, presumably, which he describes there, the visit, as a kind of tamasha, a kind of spectacle, because this is still a travelogue written in the older forms of the ajaib al-gharaib, the weird and wonderful elements of travel. But when we probe deeper into the text, we note in sort of, as it were, linguistically closer reading, we see that there's no Japanese vocabulary that enters into the text. This is interesting because, following from the researches of my Japanese colleague So Yamane, which, you know, at the same time, there was actually a Japanese official called Guy Gozaimon, who was based at Dejima, the old trading island further south of Yokohama, who actually compiled a vocabulary of Persian to be able to communicate on the, as it were, from the Japanese side with such Persian merchants, whether from India or from Iran directly. Except even had Sahabashi known about that, he wouldn't be able to read that Farsi-Japanese vocabulary because Guy Gozaimon's vocabulary was written in Japanese script. Another direct observer then, Mitlikuli Hidayat, travels there, entering to Japan in December 1903, just in time or just before the outbreak of the Russo-Japanese War. He writes up his diaries and adds to them subsequently in later years, not least through what I've called a model or a methodology of informational leveraging by drawing upon the many German sources that he was able to read. Hidayat was an official for the Iranian Telegraph Service and Postal Service who had studied in Berlin and knew German fluently. So he draws upon his own experiences, but as it were, goes towards a deeper experience or reinterpretation of those on-the-spot experiences through his reading of German accounts of Japan and German translations from Japanese. His on-the-spot observations, and indeed the tours of the party that, of course, included the deposed Iranian Prime Minister, Amin al-Sultana, included a series of accounts of newspapers, railways, schools. They visited in progressive Taraqi mode then, a girls' school in Japan. He described the new modern hotels, unlike the Mustafa Khanes of Qajar Iran at this period, or I suppose post-Qajar Iran, most of late Qajar Iran, and the Grand Emporia, the new modern shops and marketplaces of Tokyo and elsewhere. At the cultural level, though, there was a level of understanding here that is a bit of a contrast with Sahafbashi from just a decade earlier. Visiting a Shinto shrine, Hidayat uses the correct Japanese word, jingo. This is no longer a butchane, an idol house. This is a jingo. There's also a positive account of the Buddhist temples of Kyoto as well, and the cherry blossom festival, which they coincided with. There's also a sense here, the inclusion, interestingly, for someone who worked for the communication service of Iran, the inclusion of postcards he picked up along the way, including this one of one of the Ainu indigenous peoples of the northern Japanese island of Hokkaido, which had been conquered and incorporated in Japan some decades earlier. And there's a shared sense here then of Iran and Japan, at least through modernizers like Hidayat, entering into and sharing in a great global narrative here of the march of civilization, of Tamadun, that key word across the Persian world in this period. Well, what we might call, with a question mark, we might ask whether this is Iran's first book of Japanology, the earliest full-length book I've managed to find dedicated to Japan. Hidayat visited a whole series of countries, including California, included in that book of travels that Japan's in. But the earliest book of Japan I've managed to find is the Mamikati Shamsi Ta'ala, the Empire of the Rising Sun, written by Matwas Khan Malik Yans. If anyone's heard of this figure or knows anything more about him, please do tell me, because I haven't managed to establish anything more about him than the assumption that he's presumably an Armenian and he explains he's in government service. As the cover of the book notes, this is a book that is Talif al-Tarjameh, compiled and translated by Malik Yans. And Malik Yans tells us what his sources are. His two main sources then are a French author. I'm actually moving on to someone else. His two main sources. I'm getting confused here. No, leave that. I'll come back to that in a moment. The text then, so it's translated then, but it's unclear then where it's translated from. He doesn't, in this case, give a direct idea of where. Possibly from Russian, of course, which various Armenians knew, maybe from French, of course, which other Iranians knew Armenian Iranians knew through the Armenian diaspora in France at this time. Still, there's a sense of the moral strangeness of Japan in this period, coinciding, as this book does, with the outbreak of the Russo-Japanese War. There's no coincidence there, even though it coincides. Still a sense of the strangeness, the sartorial comparisons and moral strangeness of Japan. The country here is the clothing of Japan here. The kimono is compared rather negatively with the Arab habit of wearing the jalabiya, which in both cases are blown open by the wind to reveal the nakedness of the person underneath. Nonetheless, despite this sense of cultural and sartorial difference, there are very interesting comparisons with Japan, albeit drawn from European models of comparative religion at this time. Shinto then is described as being a form of natural law, drawing then, I guess, on sort of European anthropology of the 19th century. Buddhism, though, is seen rather more through an Islamic lens that we see in many other accounts of Buddhism that I look at in other chapters in my book. Buddhism then is sort of seen more problematically as breaking the bonds between God and his creation, theological reasons that I don't have time to explain now. Christianity, interestingly, in a concern that comes up in various Muslim accounts of Japan, indeed China in this period, the Christianity through the entry of Christian missionaries to the port cities, such as particularly Yokohama and Kobe, Christianity spreading fast since the gates of Japan, the port of Japan, were opened in the 1850s. There's also this concern then with Japan as a model of taraqqi, as a model of progress, educational reform, including compulsory schooling for all citizens, modern sciences, ethics, and national history. And what's interesting about this book, I think, within the context of Iranian history, is in a period we usually associate with the first decades of the 20th century with the growth of the constitutional movement and with constitutionalists in Iran, this is a text that seems to use Japan as a model for patriotism, but nonetheless for an emperor-led, a top-down, and indeed, as it were, a dictatorial modernization. It's the Mikado there, this is always called in Persian Mikado. It's Mikado-led modernization in Japan. And the infrastructures and industries and the powerful army and navy then, all of these developed to the same capacity as Europe through loyalty to a wise emperor. Lessons for Iran then from Japan, lessons in centralized dictatorial modernization on the eve of the constitutional movement. Turning to Afghanistan, or indeed via Iran, the earliest Afghan study of Japan, this book, not book length, it's in a book, it's only a chapter, is in the Shih Hazar Exile, Riazi, which he publishes then in exile in Mashhad in 1906. I don't have time to talk about the book other than to notice these truly extraordinary lithographic images here of the war in the Sea of Japan here, in what is really, I can't help but say, seems to be an example of steampunk imagery avant la lettre. Moving on to other images then, indeed other texts, the well-known but actually never previously studied Mikado Nama, published in Calcutta in 1907 by a Shirazi merchant, Hussein Ali Shirazi, telling the story, the blow-by-blow account over 100 or so pages of Shahnameh modeled verse, a blow-by-blow account of the Russo-Japanese War and the Japanese victory, of course. But what we can notice here is the way, again, this understanding, this representation of Japan comes via this informational bourse, as I've called it, of Calcutta. Not only is the book printed there, presumably the information that feeds into it comes from newspaper reports that were available to Hussein Ali Shirazi through Habl al-Matin. His book was printed on the Habl al-Matin Press. And the Habl al-Matin Press, of course, relied for many of its reports on the London Illustrated News and its correspondence elsewhere. And we'll see at the bottom of the screen here, assuming you can see my cursor, the name here, Bose, a very common Bengali name. I haven't managed to establish who exactly this Bose was, but I have managed to establish that the images here were Bose's Bengali or Calcutta-based adaptations of the illustrations of the Dutch war artist, Hermanus Willem Kukuk, who worked in Japan on behalf of the London Illustrated News, which featured these illustrations, which were presumably then sent to Calcutta and passed on to Bose, who used them in the publication here of the Mikado Nama. Back to Iran then, in the wake of the Russia-Japanese war, then there's this, again, this explosion of Japanophilia. Is it Japanology? Well, certainly we have an extremely large two-volume book here, Baqir Khan Tabrizi's Tarikh-e Aqsa-i Sharq, the history of the Far East then, again, that European moniker for the region. Two volumes, 720 pages, dwarfing earlier Persian or indeed Urdu accounts of Japan. But he names his two sources, a mysterious Monsieur Galli, I've managed to identify, tell me if you have ideas, please, afterwards, and two very clear sources that he names, Usman Sna'i and Ali Fuad, who I'll turn to in a moment, to Ottomans in that case. Tabriz is very eager to explain that what he's given here is not an afsane. This isn't a tale of Japan. This is real information derived from reliable sources, Sana'i Fuad and the mysterious Monsieur Galle. And yet it's somewhat ironic, though, that the illustrations that come in there do, in a sense, underline his this is not an afsane claim by looking like images, as it were, from more traditional lithographic and indeed manuscript illustrations of the Shahnameh. Well, what was the informational source here? Well, it was inter-Asian in this case, at least aside from Monsieur Galle, the Ottoman Russo-Japon Seferi by the aforementioned Major Usman Sna'i and Captain Ali Fuad, who were sent out to Japan as guests of the Japanese Empire, as Ottoman imperial guests to observe the course of the war. And they published their text in five volumes in 1905 in Istanbul. That was taken up a decade later, those five volumes, and translated into Dari Persian and published in Kabul in 1915 in five volumes by Mahmud Tarizi, the great modernizer, reformist, newspaper publisher, in what was at that point not only the by far the longest account of Japan published in Afghanistan, but also at this point the longest book ever published in Afghanistan at this period, giving us a sense of the importance of Japan. The Japanophilia then is cropping up in Urdu. I won't dwell on this, but even including a series of other Urdu accounts, including then a play on the Russo-Japanese War, which includes, interestingly, two fictional Muslim missionaries sent to Japan. And the attempt to convert Japan to Islam is indeed one of the ongoing concerns of this period. A Japanophilia, but not a Buddha or Shinto philia, let's say. Abdul Rashid Ibrahim then, to finish off my survey then of the sources I've been looking at, a well-known text then, but here too, although Abdul Rashid lives in Japan for some time earlier on, his intermediary language seems to be Russian. He was a Russian Siberian Tatar who publishes his book in Istanbul at the end of his travels. And he gives us at least a glimpse there of an attempt to understand the Japanese writing system, katakana, hiragana, yamotohana, etc. But what's really interesting here to me is the way he actually describes these terms as being hieroglyphic, hieroglyphics, of course, drawing upon here a Greek term, of course, being reintroduced by Egyptologists of the 19th century. I don't have time to dwell on these other figures then, but to note that one of the most fascinating bits for me of my book was then a chapter on a close study of an Indian Muslim sent to Japan to teach both Urdu and Persian at the Japanese Imperial School of Foreign Languages. But while he teaches Persian and Urdu, he's not allowed to learn Japanese because his contract very clearly explains that he's not allowed to try to speak Japanese to either his students or his colleagues. He includes the distinguished Japanese Indologist, Gamo Raichi. We have a sense of Fazli's vocabulary then, but we'll see here too, through his transliterations, this comes through the English guidebooks that he names in his in the bibliography at the end of his book. Finally, then, though, this doesn't mean that just because understanding is vicarious and indirect, doesn't mean that understanding, in my eyes, doesn't develop in these more vicarious ways. It just means that we might have to rethink some of our current fascination with closed, as it were, inter-Asian connections to see actually that knowledge flows through a larger set of Eurasian connections that include European knowledge of different regions of Asia. So when we have these translations of Japanese classical poetry into Persian in the 1940s, as a side effect, I suspect, of the opening of the Japanese embassy in Kabul in the run-up to World War II, and circling China, of course, we have these translations of the Manyoshu, the famous 7th century classical Japanese poetry, but the translation makes it clear, references and comparisons to Wordsworth and Coleridge and Keats, that this was based upon an English source text. And here we have this interplay here, which I look at throughout the book, of appreciating the other, of appreciating Japan and its classical poetry, but at the same time as projecting the self. In the very same publications at the same time, we have the question of whether Japan will now convert to Islam, now that the Quran is available, as the article explains, in Japan. So in conclusion, we've seen here a short-lived Persian Japanophilia in the decade following the Russo-Japanese War that leads to rapid changes in positive perceptions of Japan, with an emphasis on military knowledge and centralization and modernization, but not on culture or indeed language. But this didn't translate in the period I'm looking at into an enduring step-by-step development of Japanology. There's mostly mediated information, the absence of linguistic experts or institutions on the Iranian or indeed the Indian side to compare with, for example, the Russian Imperial School of Foreign Languages, nor were the direct translations from Japanese. But as I pointed out, if we recast what we're looking at as a series of Eurasian forms of intercultural understanding, we can actually recognize that a good deal of knowledge and appreciation of other cultures nonetheless emerged through these inter-Asian or indeed inter-Eurasian interactions of this period. Thank you for bearing with me.
That was absolutely fascinating. Thank you very, very much, Niall. I appreciate that. I'm going to take my prerogative. I got a lot of questions here on this. I wonder, as a starter, do we detect in these works any understanding or appreciation of how the Japanese looked at further west, in particular Iran or Afghanistan? It's interesting to me that they wouldn't let this chap learn any Japanese. So there wasn't, I mean, is that official government policy? Did that reflect a certain cultural bias or cultural predispositions on the part of the Japanese at that time, or just the ruling elite, or what?
Well, to turn to the latter, that was at the Tokyo Gakugo Gakko, the Tokyo School of Foreign Languages, this imperial school established in the 1870s. They'd had a whole series of these Indian language teachers. Fortunately, in this case, I was able to have a Japanese scholar translate a history of the school for me. So thanks to him, I was able, to actually see this was a long-standing policy of all of the Indian students that came there. I dare say that was kind of pedagogical priorities, that, the concern here is we're teaching Japanese to learn Persian. We're not interested in helping Indians or whatever. I think bear in mind also at this period that India is part of the British Empire, and Britain then from the Japanese side, Britain's an imperial ally, of course, from the 1900s of Japan. This changes very much, of course, in World War II, and the Indians have to leave by and large, apart from those, and one important figure who stays on at the school, collaborates with the Japanese, and then the Japanese have a great deal of Urdu books then published, because of course Urdu was the military Hindustani, was the language of the colonial army of India, which of course the Japanese were fighting against and trying to persuade Indian troops to join them. So it was sort of it was quite a long-standing policy, but I think one within, very much within the frameworks of Japanese imperial concerns and their sense of what becomes of a sense of a, what was it, the greater East Asian prosperity sphere, the Japanese Empire as part of Asia then.
What can we say then also about how the, two points, how these works reflect an understanding of what it was about Japan that allowed them to best Russia in this, and particularly if they weren't Muslims? If they hadn't achieved that understanding, was that that seems to have been a lack of knowledge. Now we're bringing Islam in and now they'll all kind of convert. But by the same token, the extent to which among Iranians, these ideas then filtered back into Iran. So again, in the works themselves, again, reflections of what made it superior, what allowed them to do this when the Iranians themselves couldn't do this, or when those based in India were suffering under the British, and again, by implication, weren't able to do this. And how did this filter back into the larger numbers of the intellectual classes in both countries?
Well, with the latter point, you know, I'd love to hear from, you know, more devoted, skilled and industrious researchers than myself, you know, kind of the wider reception, particularly. And, you know, my book really focuses primarily on my own research, my own sort of data set, primarily on published books, on articles I've been managed to find. But of course, there must be who knows how many other articles out there in the public sphere that we don't, at least I'm not aware of, a, you know, as it were, a JSTOR for historical Persian journals that we could find. So I'd love to hear more about that filtering back. And particularly then to get to the heart of your question, Andrew, about these debates, about how Japan manages to modernize so effectively, and yet it's not Muslim. In fact, it's not even one of the, you know, recognized religions of let's say, you know, kind of Islamic, let alone Persian consciousness. So much so that, you know, kind of the book, the texts I'm looking at from Iran, from Afghanistan, don't even have a term for Buddhism, let alone Shinto. This is still Budparasti. A text I have from an official Afghan school book published in, I think as late as about 1910, presumably used in the years afterwards, explains that apart from the religions of the book, the other religion of the world is Budparasti. And that includes everybody else, you know, kind of including the Japanese and Chinese. So this is actually quite a theological problem. And hence, I think, you know, part of this concern with Japan's modernized, and as it were, there's been a sort of, if you like, a kind of political economic accounts of Japan's modernization, which may well derive from European political economy accounts of that period. After all, that's where the information is coming from. But that does present then this moral dilemma. And, you know, there's a whole series of sort of missionaries or would-be missionaries that go out. Abdul Rashid Ibrahim is one of them. In my earlier works, I've, you know, published on the, you know, the founding of the first mosque in Japan in 1935, the translations of the Quran into Japan. So this is going on as well. So there is this kind of, you know, kind of, and there are all these rumors of has the Mikado converted, etc. So I think there is this real sort of moral tension. And I think it's notable, and I'm sort of interested in the fact that I'd love to know more about this Matuz Khan, this Armenian, whether the fact that this is an Armenian-Iranian, you know, kind of promoting Japan, although he still has concerns, I think perhaps as a Christian, you know, kind of with, you know, that there's this, you know, Buddhism undermining the relationship or the authority of the creator, of his creation. But my suspicion is that the must have been, you know, kind of pushback from clerical classes about this Japanophilia and other publications that I haven't managed to find. But certainly still, as I kind of finished off with the, you know, the Afghan newspaper, the Afghan journal report at the end, throughout this period, as much as there's the Japanophilia, there's also an attempt to convert Japan to Islam. So hence this interplay that I talk about throughout the book, a projection of the self, appreciation of the other, that these are absolutely intertwined.
I guess also, and then I'll come over because I have some questions on the site. I guess also the Japanese would have been aware to some extent of Islam if they'd gone down south, because of course Islam and whatever we want to call that area, I'm American originally, so, but I mean Malaysia, Indonesia and such, and Islam before that, they would have been aware of Islam. I'm not sure what their attitudes would have been, certainly among the intellectual classes. On that issue of Buddhism, I have a question here about this. I'm curious why Buddhism was viewed more negatively than Shinto. Buddhism has no god, but the Shinto has many deities.
Right, yeah. It's based on the, you know, the limited evidence I have on Shinto. Shinto doesn't really get sort of discussed very much, but it is in that Natawas Khan Malikian's book, albeit briefly. I think, again, it's perhaps because, you know, there's a sort of, let's say, sort of a Rousseau-esque sort of, you know, reading of Japan in, you know, perhaps the mysterious, oh no, that wasn't Monsieur Gallet. I don't know whether his sources are French or Russian, read one of the two, but they are European. But perhaps, you know, my sense that this might be, you know, a kind of Rousseau-esque sense of this is natural religion. This is a sort of an enlightenment reading of, I think, of an enlightenment sort of European reading of Shinto here, that casts it in that light that then can become more appealing, I think, more religiously neutral. And again, I mean, to cut into your question, I suppose, I mean, this is the challenge that I've been sort of finding as a historian. I have to sort of wipe out what I know or what I think I know from reading 21st century accounts of Shinto, etc. And indeed, my own visits to Shinto shrines, because they're very different from the Shinto shrines of 120 years ago, where Shinto and Buddhist shrines were intertwined spaces before the nationalization of Shinto in Imperial Japan. So I have to try to separate what I think Shinto is or was to actually trying to get a sense of, well, what my source is, you know, kind of in their very short explanations, they seem to think Shinto was, and try to work out why, based upon, again, their data sets, whether they visited Japan, whether they read European texts, or whether in some cases they kind of combined the two, as Hidayat did. Buddhism, though, I mean, you know, just to sort of riff on that slightly, one of the things that really interests me is the rediscovery of Buddhism through colonial India. We have to bear in mind that, you know, kind of the history of Buddhism had been kind of really lost in India until the 19th century. And this is sort of combined efforts of Orientalists and, you know, Sri Lankan Buddhist scholars, who then get brought into the, you know, South Asian Indian British imperial remit. Then a number of Bengali scholars too, work together with the Asiatic Society of Bengal and go up, for example, to Kathmandu, to the Royal Library there, and find old Sanskrit texts which have been destroyed in India centuries, or rotted away in India, you know, perhaps the best part of a millennium earlier. So there's this rediscovery of Buddhism in India, combined sort of, you know, kind of Orientalist, or indeed Orientalist who happen to be Indian as well as European, I guess, in this period, the same methods, the same techniques, the same interests. And this starts to filter through into works into Urdu. And there's a big wave of works on the Buddha and on the history of Buddhism in Urdu from around 1900. But it actually takes quite a while for them to recognize, indeed for Europeans to recognize as well, that the Buddha, A, is a historical person, not a god, and B, that this historical person lived in India. So we've got some of these Urdu texts saying, you know, oh, the Buddha lived in China, or, you know, kind of, or from Moholistan he lived, or, you know, Mongolia. And then there's the reclaiming of the Buddha as Indian. And then we get the sort of the nationalization sort of accounts of the Buddha, which ultimately results in, you know, the Indian flag of 1947. Which of course was again quite strategic, because there were so few Buddhists in India in that period, for Nehru nationalists, and actually was quite a helpfully neutral religious symbol to put on the sign. So, but this happens much more in Indian languages, a whole range of Indian languages beyond Urdu, than in Persian. So Persian, there's this thing from Persian of Buddhology, or indeed Buddhophilia, is much, much more limited, and seems to really crop up more by the 20s and 30s. In Afghanistan, when we have French archaeologists of the Dafa excavating Buddhist archaeological sites, I published on this some years ago, The Afghan Discovery of Buddhism, about how then we have kind of major Afghan intellectuals, Ali Ahmad Khorzad especially, writing accounts of Buddhism and then creating a neutral vocabulary to describe not Buts as idols, but mujassimet. These are now statues rather than idols. But this actually happens rather more in Afghanistan than it does in Iran. But then in Iran, you know, at least I've managed to find by the 30s, we start to have sort of an interest in Buddhism. And even one figure I found sort of, you know, kind of interprets Buddhism in by quoting Rumi and so on. But, you know, again, these are, you know, a century long process, effectively.
Question about material culture. I wonder if you've given some thought to the rather significant collections of artifacts, glass and ceramic objects, and carpets and textiles, which arrived at Japanese temples from as early as the 8th century. These objects were incorporated into ritual practices and processionals. The famous floats with Safavid carpets are perhaps the best example. This, I assume, means more than just exotica.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, these are sort of, you know, sense of tremendous fascination for me. You know, I have a, you know, long interest from my years of knocking around Iran and elsewhere, you know, in textile history. And those early, not only Iranian, but actually particularly really rarely, kind of as a Mughal carpet in one of the temples of Kyoto that I managed to see on one of my visits. But again, this is a rather like the Silk Road paradigm. We don't know how many hands those passed through on the one hand. I'm going to have to have three hands here. Bear with me. On the other hand, these, of course, they don't speak. They're not linguistic objects. So fascinated as I am in my art historical interests and textile history interest with these wonderful objects and their reuse, I guess, in these very different contexts, indeed for those temporal possessions, they are, you know, they are silent. They can be read and reinterpreted in entirely different ways as they are. They're not objects of, you know, let's say, culture in the language of, in the terms of linguistic, theological, conceptual intermediaries. And thirdly, on my third hand, then, it goes back to the point I made sort of in the sort of basic premises of my study, of my book in this talk, that we shouldn't, the false assumption of continuous knowledge across the centuries. And that can be the case, you know, often we not only project back knowledge, we assume there was what was known in, say, 1200 was also known in 1800. That was simply not the case. A case in point then being, let's say, the famous 17th century Safanai Suleimani, this Persian account of primarily Thailand, but from based upon the late Safavid embassy to Ayodhya in Thailand, an account of Japan in that Persian text from what, the 1660s, that was taken presumably from Dutch merchants who were also in Ayodhya. But that text was never published until what it was, 1990s, seems to have been left lingering in however many, one or two, whatever manuscripts, and is never referred to whatsoever in any of the sources I've looked at. So even when we have, you know, not just a carpet, but, you know, a pretty detailed, if, you know, indirect account of Japan from the 1600s, that's not known. And then similarly, you know, I discuss in my book, like, say, Battuta, the rediscovery of Ibn Battuta. When Ibn Battuta gets published and indeed translated into languages like Urdu, and indeed when Ibn Battuta gets discovered in China in the 1920s as well, you know, kind of a... So again, and of course, Ibn Battuta gives an account of China, and scholars have argued whether he really went or whether that was indirect, the Marco Polo kind of debate taken to Battuta. So, so textiles are really fascinating, but I think we have to sort of, you know, as we do with any item of evidence, what can they tell us? And when do they tell us that about? Mm. Almost makes sense.
I had a reference to the writings of Judith Gautier, died in World War I. And someone wondered if you were aware of those, any use at all?
No, I don't at all. I've written it down.
Gautier, Judith.
Okay, Judith Gautier. No, I looked those up, and thank you. I'm always on the eye for interesting sources. Thank you, whoever that was.
And a final question I had, just an understanding, and I'm going to morph the question a little bit. What was the understanding of the actualities of the Russo-Japanese War? Did they get into actual confrontations and lineups and battle plans and such, or was this, that wasn't really the issue? The issue was something larger, the defeat and the victory.
Oh, it was extremely detailed. I mean, the Tabernese volume then, the two volumes, 720 page one, I mean, that is primarily an account of war. Albeit also, and similarly, the five volume Ottoman text, and then it gets translated into Persian, into Dari, and in Kabul. So these are primarily accounts of war, but also built in and around them are sort of shorter accounts of the elements of Japanese culture that, you know, kind of enabled that success. Ditto the Mikado Name is really a sort of, you know, it's a series of battle scenes and so on, albeit of course done in more aesthetic mode. So they're actually, you know, kind of, and also it's kind of series of illustrations too. So albeit in the Tabernese one, as we've seen, you know, I mean, that's the kind of the interesting element there for me in the Tabernese one, that that you might have, you know, kind of a Tabrizi who's a, you know, translator with these very kind of clear concerns of state building, modernization, etc. And yet there isn't then, let's say, the development then, I guess, perhaps of lithograph, or at least he couldn't find an illustrator whose illustrations could match up with this picture of modernization and so on. Bear in mind at this point, we don't have, you know, we don't have photographic printing in Iran yet. That will start off a couple of decades afterwards and so on. So there's still reliance upon these, you know, kind of lithographic illustrators. So yeah, you can have a very detailed text written by, as I say, you know, two Ottoman military observers, blow by blow, pretty much. But of course, that doesn't necessarily lead up to, you know, battle plans and images of, I don't know, kind of whatever new form of a Gatling gun or whatever it would have been, you know, kind of that was being used.
I have what seems to be the final question, and then we'll log off because we've gone well over time. So thank you very much. This may be a little off the track here, but the question has to do with Japan's progress during the Meiji Restoration. Why was it that Japan finally chose to attack Russia?
Oh, well, you know, I have to say, I'll happily confess my ignorance here. You know, I'm not primarily a historian of Japan. I could probably kind of think back through that and think of my rationales and reasons. I guess kind of too expanding. Well, you know, the classic Thucydidean model that we hear a lot about nowadays with the US and China is, you know, an ascendant empire and an incumbent empire, an ascendant empire.
What was the perception in the sources?
Oh, I see. Well, I mean, I think what's really interesting here is the fact that it really is. It's the Russo-Japanese War and the Japanese victory that really puts Japan on the map for Iran, but also for the Arab world and also for Indians as well, which is interesting because, of course, the opening of Japan in the 1850s, the Meiji Restoration a few years later, this is, you know, 40 to 50 years before the Russo-Japanese War. And, you know, we've had certainly Indian merchants, Bombay-based merchants, the Sassoons who'd come from, Jewish merchants come from Baghdad to Bombay and then further east, Parsi merchants as well. I don't know about Iranian merchants, but quite possibly in Japan well before 1904. But again, this is part of my point that connection doesn't necessarily lead to comprehension. There's a sort of paradigm in world history that knowledge travels with trade. But, you know, I'm sort of tearing apart or questioning that paradigm because trade came a lot earlier and, you know, not many merchants wrote books, probably because they realized that knowledge of another society is actually an intellectual commercial asset that they don't want to share with their competitors. So it makes perfect sense, actually, when we start to think about it. So the Russo-Japanese War then, that, you know, kind of is the starting point of Japan affiliate, not actually the commercial opening of Japan.
Terrific. That's absolutely excellent. Thank you very, very much, Professor Niall Green from UCLA. And with that, I wish everyone a pleasant good afternoon or good evening or the rest of the morning for you, Niall, there in Los Angeles. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Andrew, and thank you all for tuning in.